On this week's 51%, we speak with the author of a book about the women who fought for the right to vote.
Alice Paul, man, her dedication, her single-mindedness, and her willingness to put her life at risk, you know, in order to give us the right to vote. Oh my God, I love the woman.
And we hear how heroin addiction can trap women into becoming victims of human trafficking. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Why can't the world be like little yellow roses? Lies they don't know, truth only they grow. I've always believed all men are equal, whatever color.
In July 1848, attendees at the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, demanded voting rights for women. And 72 years later, a young state legislator arrived at the Tennessee House of Representatives with a note from his mother and cast the tie-breaking vote that ratified the 19th Amendment. What happened in between is often overlooked, but it is presented in a book entitled Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote. The author is Susan Zimmet, executive director of nonprofit Hunger Action Network in New York and a former New Paltz town supervisor, the first woman in the post. She also is president of 2020 Project Women, a nonprofit created to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. Though the book is for everyone, it is written with a young reader audience in mind. Zimmet tells us why.
You know, I feel that the story of the woman's right to vote really is a story that's not known by many, many women, and I think of myself, who was always really involved, who was always really political, even in, you know, middle school and high school, where I worked on campaigns, making phone calls. I even knew nothing about this movement and what these women went through to get us the right to vote. And when I started learning about this, I was like amazed at the story and what these women went through. And it's really, really critically important that young girls who are basically, you know, facing a lot of misogyny, facing a two-tiered system of, you know, in terms of thinking of girls not capable of doing the same kind of thing, you know, men do or boys do. You know, it's really important to me that young girls understand through this story what these women went through, that when these women were young, that they didn't even have the ability to speak out in public. They didn't have the ability to go to work and keep their own money. They didn't have the ability if, you know, like, you know, a man beat them up to basically go to the police and make a report. They were their husband's property if they were married women. So many young girls have no clue what these women went through, but against all odds, against all adversity, these women fought and fought and fought and dedicated their life to get us the right to vote, which now gives us the ability today to affect who's going to get elected and who's going to make the decisions on the laws that affect us, our life, our bodies. And so I want to empower young girls to learn to never say no. Never let a man, you know, tell them they can't do something, to believe in themselves and understand that, yes, they can make a difference and that they need to register to vote when they turn 18 and they need to vote in every single solitary election because they need for their voice to be heard. They need to run for office, or if they end up in publishing, if they end up in the medical profession, if they end up in the science profession, in banking, no matter what they do, that they have the right to be the chief operating officer, the chief executive officer, the president of the company, and nobody can stop them.
So the centennial of women's suffrage in New York was in 2017, and now we're working our way to the 2020 suffrage centennial on the national level, and you are president of an organization created for that 2020 centennial. And when you took to writing this book, obviously you knew those dates were coming up, but what you didn't yet know was the Me Too movement would come to light and that women's voices were being listened to in a way they weren't before. What do you make of all this? What do you think of this?
Oh, I mean, obviously, I mean, I'm very sad that this is our reality, but I'm incredibly happy that finally the voices of women are getting taken very serious and that there are consequences that we are seeing from the actions that these men have done to these women. So, of course, I'm very happy about the time, but I also, you know, understand how quickly we can lose our rights. And one thing that young women and women all over need to understand is that the only protection we really have in the Constitution is the right to vote. there are three constitutional amendments that were given for black men to basically ensure that they were protected not just for their right to vote, but other equality type issues that, you know, needed to be done through the Constitution to protect them. The only one for women is our right to vote. So all of our rights are really precarious in a lot of ways until we get an Equal Rights Amendment passed that would then end up protecting us in the Constitution. I've always been very focused on, you know, equality and women's issues. I've never let anybody throughout my life ever sort of stand in my way of getting something done. I've always been a little bit more outspoken, and I've always sort of somewhat pushed the envelope. So when I ended up picking up an article that talked about the Forgotten Movement, which was the centennial movement for women's suffrage, and I read this story, I thought, how could I not know this story? I don't get it. How could I not know it? And, of course, I wanted to know more. So I went up to Seneca Falls. I went up to Rochester. I, you know, met with the Susan B. Anthony House, with the Matilda Jocelyn Gage House. I met with the, you know, all sorts of people who have been working on this issue for a long time and said, I want to get involved in the 100th anniversary. This needs to be a big deal. And I created my not-for-profit 2020 Project Women and got some great women involved. And so we've been sort of working on this, you know, little by little, but we all always get busy and life gets in the way. And, you know, when I was talking about the 100th anniversary, 7 years ago, people weren't as interested because, you know, people don't like to think 7 years out. It's like, what's going to happen tomorrow, the next day, the next day. So, you know, here we are. I got this opportunity 3 years ago to basically write this book, which was an amazing opportunity. And so I started working on this book. It was very exciting as we were working on it because we thought that there might be a first woman president, and we thought the book would be coming out around the time when there'd be a first woman president. And when I was working on the book, it was interesting. I was also the town supervisor of New Paltz at the time, and I would come home from meetings, and my husband would say a lot to me, you know, you wouldn't be getting treated the way you get treated sometimes if you were a man. And that was very clear to him. And I would sit down and I'd be very upset about something that might have happened, but then I would be reading about these women who had such a tough road to hoe where they couldn't even, you know, basically speak in public. You know, they would make me feel a lot better about my position of being a woman elected official and the things that I had to deal with. So we worked on the book and worked on the book, and were very, very excited when the book was getting close to being finished. And then all of a sudden the Me Too movement happened, and all of a sudden all of the sexism that's coming out now and everything. So, of course, the timing for this book could not be better. You've got the 100th anniversary of the women's right to vote, which helps for young women and women all over to understand that you've got to stand up, you've got to speak up, and you can get something done. And then, you know, now with the whole Me Too movement, it's like, let's keep speaking out. And then simultaneously in New York State, we actually have a ballot line called the Women's Equality Party that I'm very involved in, and I'm on the executive committee, where we can actually say to candidates, you want to run? You want our line? What do you think about women? What do you think about women's equality? How are you going to help women? How are you going to help children? And that's very, very, very powerful.
Talk about powerful, the women in history who led to our path of voting. I mean, obviously, that's what your book is about.
Not only do you have people like Susan B. Anthony, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Carrie Chapman Catt, who were out there fighting really, really hard, you know, putting themselves through great, you know, great discomfort to do what they did. But then you have the women who actually starved themselves, were put into jail, were actually tortured in jail, all for what? Protesting the fact that women didn't have the right to vote? So women really put themselves in really dangerous situations in order to try to accomplish something that ultimately did get accomplished. And ultimately, all of the young girls today, you know, have this right. And so we take this vote for granted. We don't understand what these women went through to get us the right to vote and how important it is for us to honor them by voting and having a voice in the government that's actually going to be representing us. And, you know, if you look at the most recent election in Alabama, who is it that actually came out and voted and made a difference? It was black women.
What about accomplishing getting this book, these stories, into schools?
I would love to see this book be in the curriculum of every school nationally so that basically every middle schooler is asked to read this book, you know, so they understand this history, and I hope that happens.
Now, you were supervisor of a Hudson Valley town, New Paltz, in Ulster County, and now we're seeing a lot of women voicing interest in running for offices on every level. There are organizations dedicated to offering resources to help women realize their campaigns. So what do you think of this, and what do you say to women who are looking to run?
First of all, it's totally fantastic. They have more women now looking to run for office than ever, ever, ever before. There are organizations that, you know, do training for women that normally get maybe 300 applications. They're getting like 25,000, and I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you. I just read some organization that got like 25,000 women looking to run, like, for office. I think it's absolutely fantastic. Now, one of the things that I found really interesting, when they asked me to run for supervisor of New Paltz, I knew nothing about local government. I wasn't really involved in local government. I actually said no 7 times. I wasn't looking to do that. I was working on a kids' television show. I was happily raising my 2 young kids. But when they asked me to run for supervisor, I said no 7 times. I finally broke down the 8th time and said, okay, I'll do it, even though I didn't know what I was getting myself involved in. I learned afterwards that if you ask a man to run for office, they actually usually say, oh, I can do that, and say yes right away. It's very traditional for a woman to say no 7 times because they don't think they're capable of doing it. And it's, really interesting. Now, I always like to think of myself as out of the box, so I was very upset to find out that I just actually followed, a pattern that's very common. But most women think they're not capable of doing it, and that is the furthest thing from the truth. Now, again, I had never gone to a town board meeting. I didn't know how to run a town board meeting. We were just trying to stop a big mega mall that was coming into our town that would have destroyed the vibrancy of the downtown. And that's, I was involved in that battle, and that's how I got known, and people asked me to run. And so when I got out and I started talking to people, I did my research, I did my homework, I learned about a lot of different things, I expanded my universe. And when I got out there and spoke to people, people felt like, you know what? She seems really intelligent. She seems to know what she's talking about. We don't want this mall. We're going to give her a chance. And I ended up getting elected against all odds, and it became the most watched election in the Hudson Valley because I ran against a 3-term incumbent whose family helped to settle the town that I moved into. So when I got into office, if you're relatively intelligent, it's like I learned what I had to do. I listened. I worked with people. We got things done, and, I had 20 years of political experience from that moment. I went on for 20 years serving my town as supervisor, as county legislator. I ran for state senate and whatever. And I did the job, and I did a good job and got a lot of things done. So I think to all these women who are out there thinking about doing it, they need to first know, yes, they can. Don't let anybody ever tell you you can't. Yes, you can. You can do it. You can run. You can win. And when you win, you could serve admirably and get great things done that will make a difference for your town, for your village, for your county, for your state, for the nation. You have the power by running and winning to affect legislation that can make a difference in people's lives. But that also goes for any young girl or boy, in a sense, who, again, going back to, if you work for a company and you think you're being mistreated, or you think you deserve a raise, or you think you deserve a promotion, you speak up, you ask for what you think, and believe it or not, you actually just might get it, which is what happened with me when I was in the private sector working in advertising. And I remember reading an article when Working Women just had come out where they said women have a tendency to put their head down and work really hard and think they'll be recognized, but men understand you have to, you have to have small talk, you have to do cocktail party kind of talk, you have to do this, you have to schmooze, and whatever. So I got done reading this article. I went right into the big, gigantic boss and said, this is all the work that I've been doing. This is what I've accomplished. I want a raise, and I want a promotion. And guess what? 2 weeks later, I got a raise and a promotion.
Okay, Susan, I'm going to bring you around to the book again and ask, who do you most relate to in this story, in this history? Who do you see yourself most like?
It's really funny because, there's a big debate within the women's movement. Was it Carrie Chapman Catt who really made the difference? She was the one who did the state by state, when you had to get each state to ratify it, the 3/4 of the state, she did the state by state campaign where she would go state by state. She was incredibly methodical. She did what had to get done, and there are certain people who believe it was because of her that the movement, we got the right to vote. Then there are others who believe Alice Paul, who was the one who came back from England, who was a second wave of, you know, the suffragists who came back from England where they were really radicalized and came back and said, we don't have the time to wait, and we're going to just protest, and we're going to do civil disobedience. And these women were the first women to ever, first people ever to do an act of civil disobedience where they protested in front of the White House and then ultimately got arrested, even though they were doing peaceful protests. Basically, it was them in jail and doing the force feeding that forced the president to sort of say, okay, we got to give these women the right to vote, you know, and they did. So there are people who think it was Alice Paul. There were people who think it was Carrie Chapman, I believe it was everybody and every individual together in the movement that made the movement happen. You know, it's all of us together working and rowing in the same direction to get something done. So I don't think there's certainly no one heroine, but obviously Alice Paul is the one that I really related to. And I would love to think that I would have the courage that she had to face what she did in jail and what she did. But, you know, I really, really, really related to her and just adored her.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
But, you know, I adore them all, you know. And then again, there's people like Matilda Joslyn Gage, who people don't even really know about, but she was probably one of the most radical early movers and shakers of the movement, who really believed, you know, not just in the right to vote, but in total women's equality and the importance of, you know, the separation of church and state and, you know, bigger issues of, you know, women's equality, not just the right to vote, who was written out of history that a lot of people don't know about. But she's being put back into history more and more and more, and she's quite a remarkable woman also. So there's so many different women to, you know, relate to and to admire and to feel like, you know, there's a little bit of you in the Susan B. Anthony, there's a little bit of you in the Matilda Joslyn Gage, there's a little bit of you in, you know, this person, but Alice Paul, man, her dedication, her single-mindedness and her willingness to put her life at risk, you know, in order to give us the right to vote, oh my God, I love the woman.
But that's an important point to make, though you may relate to one from a personal standpoint. It was a bunch of women. And this is a piece of history that's been left out about a lot of courageous women. So it's time to bring them to the forefront.
It's also really important, too, in all fairness, we can't leave out the men who actually were out there fighting for us and the men that actually, you know, worked with this woman and supported the women to get this done. And ultimately, it was the men who had a vote to give us the right. So it really was, you know, all of these women in the forefront and all of these men, you know, like supporting them and pushing them along. So, you know, it wasn't just a battle that women fought. It was a battle that women and men fought, but it was a battle for the woman's right to vote.
What about the title Roses and Radicals? It's a great title. How'd you come to it?
Oh, isn't it fantastic? Well, first it started, the working title was Yellow Roses. And the reason the working title was Yellow Roses at the beginning was because what you will learn when you read this story is that basically when a man supported a woman's right to vote, he wore a yellow rose on his lapel. If a man was against the woman's right to vote, he wore a red rose. And the red rose was considered the anti-suffrage rose. The title of the book was called Yellow Roses. It was a working title because I loved the story of the yellow roses and, you know, and how what the yellow roses stood for. But as we worked with the book and stuff, we wanted to keep the roses, and we didn't want to lose the roses. But, you know, these women really were radicals and the first, you know, real radicals for their time. So the title Roses and Radicals ended up being the title everybody agreed on. And I just love that title. And even though I loved Yellow Roses, I even love Roses and Radicals even more. Roses and Radicals. That's what this book is all about. You know, the yellow roses, the right to vote, and these radical women who took the future into their own hands and made it happen.
That was Susan Zimmet talking about her book, Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote. Heroin addiction can trap women in a life of sex work and often leave them at risk of exploitation by human traffickers. A national hotline has tracked thousands of calls in the last 3 years from victims of human trafficking who report struggling with opioid addiction. Reporter Esther Honig spent time in Columbus, Ohio, talking to the young women who come out looking for customers.
On a cold winter night, I find a young woman walking down an alleyway off Sullivan Avenue. Side Effects agreed not to use her name because she feared retribution from her drug dealer for talking to a reporter. She's 30, petite with red hair, and tells me she struggled with addiction for 3 years. Recently, though, she managed to stop using heroin for over a year.
I lost my job about a month ago, and one thing led to another.
Then she relapsed and wound up here.
On a day-to-day basis, I obviously walked down Sullivan to feed my addiction, to eat, to sometimes find a place to sleep.
Sullivan Avenue cuts across the Hilltop, a neighborhood in Columbus with one of the highest rates of poverty and crime. On any given day, there are dozens of young women out here. Clients honk to signal their interest, and the women get into their cars. According to data from local law enforcement, prostitution-related arrests have steadily increased over the last 3 years, and the vast majority of arrests take place here on Sullivan. Sister Nadine Buchanan, a Dominican nun, drives up and down Sullivan, her car filled with bags of food.
And I just saw one woman right now that I've given to before.
She's been coming here several times a week for the last year, ever since she realized so many women were in need of help.
I'm looking for ladies to give lunches to and personal products. They always tell me they look forward to my meals. You know, they look forward to seeing me.
Many of these women work for themselves to support their addiction. Others are coerced by pimps or dealers who take their earnings in exchange for drugs. In either case, to get out of this life, they need to kick heroin. Sister Nadine packs slips of paper with numbers for local treatment centers into their sack lunches, but she knows getting in can be a gamble.
A lot of times it depends on who you know, but usually they all have a waiting line or they're full.
Most of these women are in their 20s. They're dressed in jeans, sweatpants, and heavy coats. Sister Nadine says she's learned to spot them by their walk, the way they wander without any particular place to go, or how they wait at bus stops but never board any buses.
Honey, would you like a lunch? How are
you
today? You having a hard day?
All right, yeah. It's been a rough day for me.
Most of them are also very thin.
Oh, it's nothing to find someone that's a size zero.
Nearly all the women I interviewed for this story said they often go days without food or sleep. They live in houses that are either abandoned or run by drug dealers. Some work as much as 18 hours a day.
And sometimes when I come home, I just need to be quiet. And I say, I have been to hell today. And it's the truth.
Back in the alley where I met the young woman at the beginning of the story, she tells me she's been beaten and raped by customers. She knows this work exposes her to things like HIV, but stopping is just as terrifying.
Is it, do you ever wish you could just step out of risky what you're doing, or?
Every second.
What's stopping you?
I can't handle withdrawing.
Mm-hmm.
For women like her, this is the end of the road and few people manage to find a way home. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Esther Honig.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. A Nebraska couple who has planned several honor flights to Washington for war veterans is organizing a new trip, this one just for women. Bill and Yvonne Williams say the Nebraska Female Veterans Flight is for women who served in the European or Pacific theaters during World War II or during the wars in Vietnam, Korea, the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, or Iraq. Plans for the trip call for a charter aircraft with an all-female crew to fly 135 veterans, volunteer assistants, and media members, all women, to see the memorials in the nation's capital. The tentative date is in September, and the trip is expected to cost about $175,000, including the jet, bus transportation, meals, and other expenses. And the couple hopes to raise this money by reaching out to companies and organizations led by women. The Williamses are not veterans themselves, but have 4 sons who have served in the military. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1488.